whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you.
And I know I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues it faces every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast, and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy.
Wayne Brown is with us. He's the author of Alone in My Universe, Struggling with an Orphan Disease in an Unsympathetic World. And for Wayne Brown, the symptoms started when he was a very young man. His jaw hurt one day, and it hurt a day, hurt at night, and he couldn't explain why. And that was just the first of many painful signs that Wayne was growing at an alarming rate. And in 2004, he was diagnosed with a pituitary gland problem that causes, it's called giantism. And let's say, Wayne, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here with you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. When it must have been a shock to you to find yourself starting to grow. How old were you at the time this started to happen?
Well, Michael, when I first started to notice the growth, I was around 24 years old, and my father was very sick with brain cancer. Mm. So that was really what was obsessing our entire family, was really taking care of him and his needs.
Sure.
And I remember complaining about, you know, the aches and pains, but so many of them were explained away by the symptoms of the stress of dealing with an ill parent.
Now, by the way, when we talk about the symptoms, yes, some pain and then jaw pain, etc. But what about the growth? When did you begin to take a look in the mirror one day and realize you were bigger?
Well, that was part of the problem, because we were dealing with the symptoms from my father. I was having a lot of bad food, and we were keeping horrible hours, and so the growth was largely attributed at the time to poor diet, because I was eating just horribly unhealthy foods, and we just didn't stop to notice the sheer volume of food I was eating. I remember at the time I could gorge on what would be two people's meals, and then an hour and a half later, I'm starving again. And it was really, food became my all-consuming obsession, but because we had this huge cloud hanging over our heads, it was very easy to get distracted. For most patients with this disease, it actually takes, on average, about 10 years from the onset of symptoms to diagnosis.
Now, Wayne, when we talk about giantism, you know, you're talking about eating a tremendous amount of food. Normally, when someone thinks giant, they think tall. But
right, we get the giantism symptoms that are more associated with height in people who start to have these symptoms onset during the pubescent period.
Yeah.
That's where you get the people who become very tall, who become extraordinary in height, like some of the basketball athletes that have had this disease. With a lot of people who have the disease onset after they go through that pubescent growth period, the growth is really internal. And the way I was describing it the other day to someone was, it's kind of like having a plastic garbage bag and you just keep trying to shove more and more into it, where, yes, it will expand to compensate, but it's going to, the outer lining is going to keep wearing out and wearing out, which is where a lot of us suffer tremendous joint pains. At my maximum, when I was first diagnosed, I was 340 pounds, and now I'm down to about 220 or 225.
No, but what about your height? Did it affect your height at all?
Not so much. I mean, I'm taller than what the average person would be considered. I'm about 6'3". Yeah. We have a lot of members who are extremely taller than I am, but we have a great number of members who are extremely shorter than I am. And as far as height alone, that is not something that you could identify most of our members by, because many of them are of average or shorter than average stature. That's just one of many symptoms that are associated with acromegaly.
Yeah, see, I want to go back to where I was early on when we talked about giantism. Not necessarily the first picture that one would get in their mind would be height, but it's not height. Right. 300 and some odd pounds is a very big man. Now, when I was starting this out and talking about what happened to you, I said giantism. I couldn't pronounce the actual name of the disease. What? How do you pronounce that?
That's no problem. That's actually very typical, Michael. The pronunciation is acromegaly. And actually, when I was first diagnosed with the disease, I went home and I tried to do some research on the disease, and I had such a difficult time remembering the disease that when I tried to look it up online, I couldn't even find the definition. When I tried to put it into Google, Google didn't even come close to coming up with what I could have possibly meant.
Now, by the way, one of the things that is critically important
in my universe, because quite honestly, people who do suffer with this disease do have that loneliness, because so many people don't realize about the disease, including many of us who are diagnosed with it.
Now, by the way, one of the most important things that I have found over the years in all of the different interviews with somebody who's had some kind of a disability, a disease, or whatever the case may be, was that they felt alone, because when they were alone with it, they couldn't explain it to anybody, and they got embarrassed, and for the most part, emotionally and physically, they hid. Now, what you've done with this, and I think it's a phenomenal idea, you've created the acromegaly. Did I say it right? Acromegaly?
Very close. Acromegaly, yes.
Oh, acromegaly. Okay, you've created the acromegaly community, and that's a .com. And I think that's extremely important, because when somebody gets something like this that is not average, that's not normal, when they go to the doctor's office, nobody even knows what it is that's causing it, it needs other people there for support.
You're absolutely right. And actually, you hit into something that's very essential, Michael. One of the things that I've noticed about this book is I've had the opportunity to talk to a lot of people who have read the book. Some are family members, and some are people who are dealing with other medical issues, like you said. And every person who's read the book, and I'm talking with backgrounds in every single disease, some people even including addiction disease, have come to me and said, wow, this book really spoke to me personally. And when the family members or the loved ones come back after reading the book, initially, some of them get a bit uneasy, saying, well, this person wasn't alone. They had me. They had my wife, my child, this person, that person. So they weren't alone. And when they go and they read the book, they say, oh, okay, I understand, because this book is actually a tribute to our loved ones and how much we love and appreciate all the good deeds they did. But at the end of the day, there is that loneliness. There is that disconnect, because we end up having to walk that path totally by ourselves. And that's why I created the community, so that way people can talk to each other and share their experiences and share their laughs sometimes and frequently share their tears.
And the biggest problem, and I'm going to take this to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've had a tremendous amount of people over the years who've been on the air with me with this, and it usually somebody gets, when they hit bottom, they finally go for help. But what they find is the people that are there to help have, quote unquote, Wayne, been there, done that. It's not academic. It doesn't come out of a book. It is people who have had the problem truly relate, not understand. Understand doesn't work. That truly relate and recognize what it is that you're going through. That in and of itself is it's a staple, because without that, you're in trouble. Somebody can talk to you all day long of what they've learned out of a book, but unless they're living that, it doesn't mean a whole lot.
That is such an essential part of really working with someone who has that extraordinary loneliness, is the fact that they can relate on an interpersonal level. One of the things that I've been saying since we first started the groups, and we just started out with a couple of social networking pages on MySpace, which begot Facebook, which eventually begot the website and the charitable organization as a whole. The one thing I have always maintained is that the people who are at their strongest, I always ask them to pay it forward and help out those who aren't currently at their strongest. Because there's going to be a day where they're not feeling so great, and they're going to appreciate the hand up. One of the things that I really loved, I was a huge Tim Russert fan when he was alive.
Yeah.
And one of the comments that he made that truly rang strong with me was the quote that he said, that the greatest exercise you can give a heart is to reach down and help up your fellow man.
Sure. I mean, there's no question.
That's exactly what we try to do.
There is no question about that. Let me ask you this. We're running out of time. The real question here basically is this. I got a couple of minutes to go, but I want to make sure that we get all of this in. How do I access the information? How do I get into the online? How do I find the groups that could help me if I had this problem?
Well, we have a number of ways to get in. Number one, we have the website, which is acromegalycommunity.com. I'll spell that for you. It's A-C-R-O, M as in Mary, E-G-A-L-Y, community.com. We also have a Facebook page, which would be facebook.com/alone.book. And if they want to, they can call my office directly, and I'll be more than happy to speak with anyone about any concern. And that phone number is 716-844-8780.
Now, by the way,
I'm happy to talk to anyone. That's one of the things that I'm most proud of, is that our organization is built upon the kindness of others.
Now, let me ask you this question. Let's say, for instance, that I know somebody, which I don't, but I know somebody who is, I'm starting to see the symptoms of this. I'm starting to see them overeat, and it's not just weight, and there are certain symptoms. Is there any place we can go to the web and do an FAQ of frequently asked questions somewhere to find out? Because if the person themselves may not know, if somebody is aware enough, then they can spot this and get right down to the core of the problem.
Absolutely. We actually, if you go to acromegalycommunity.com, we have a whole list of symptoms that are associated with acromegaly. And just to go over some of them, it includes some of the more common ones, and some of the more obvious ones, for lack of a better word, are enlarged hands and feet, where people will actually see their hands and feet grow. At the maximum, my shoes were 16EE, and now that I've been in treatment, I've been very lucky, and my feet and hands have actually shrunk, and my shoe is down to, depending on the cut, a 12 or a 13. So it was very exciting to me when I could actually buy my shoes in stores again. My gloves shrank from a size 7X down to an extra large.
Wow.
Some of the other features of the disease include facial changes, where people develop a tremendous underbite and an enlarged forehead. The severe joint pain that we described earlier. People can also suffer excessive sweating, headaches, colon polyps. And this is one of the reasons why people do suffer for so long, is because there are so many incongruent symptoms that unless you have a medical doctor who's trained in what this disease is or has exposure to it previously, it's nearly impossible to diagnose. Now, if people do go to our website, not only do we have information on the signs and symptoms of acromegaly, we also have information, and this is good for anyone, information on drug financial support for people who need help with prescriptions. We have information on stretching for people who have joint pain issues. Our blog, our networking, all that is totally free. Becoming a member of Acromegaly Community is totally free for anyone who wants to join. That's one thing that I was very passionate about when we were creating this organization, is that money should never be a barrier to support.
Wonderful. Wayne, we're out of time. And by the way, I want to thank you so much for your time. And I think it's absolutely wonderful for what you're doing, because what a wonderful, if you think about it, that you couldn't have got a greater legacy to leave on this planet when it's time.
I thank you very much, Michael, and have a great night.
Oh, you too. Thanks, Wayne. Good night.
When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see, why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places. I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Stephen Mulcahy with us. Stephen Mulcahy is a personal life coach. He helps mostly female clientele to make the transition from toxic modes of behavior that can sabotage personal and professional relationships. Stephen started his coaching business, Life Works by Stephen, in 2005 to help women deal with the sometimes overwhelming prospect of starting a new personal life while being able to provide for themselves and their family. Stephen holds a bachelor's degree in management. An experienced manager, Stephen is able to weave professional success with personal fulfillment. He is also an ordained interfaith minister, and Stephen honors all paths to a greater life, fulfillment, and peace, and a Reiki master. So let us say, Stephen, I welcome to the show.
Good evening, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Stephen, when we talk about a life coach, there's so many different definitions of what that is. And I know you're specifically targeting that woman who needs help. But what is a life coach, actually, when you get right down to the bottom of it, to define it in a way that we can practically get our arms around?
I think in a short blurb would be that a life coach is much like a consultant, not a therapist. A life coach works with the immediate problems to find immediate solutions. Life coaching can be in corporate, can be in personal, such as I do, and can be a mixture of both. But the real difference for clients is that we're not going to look back into your past, into your far distant past, and look at why something happened, say, for instance, when you were a child, but rather what is it as an adult that needs to be repositioned.
Okay, well, I think repositioned is an extremely important word. Are we talking about in the shift the way one thinks?
Absolutely. Oftentimes, I would like to use the phrase that clients are virtually in neutral. When I deal with many clients, various factors come into play that make it so they really can't move forward at all. It could be interpersonal relationships, finances, professional obstacles, and it can be a mix of all that into one. But ultimately, to take a client from where they were on our first interaction to where they are at the end of our sessions together and working together, that's really a fulfilling goal for me as a coach.
You know, coming from neutral, but also coming from a place, neutral also defines as nothing. And coming from a place of nothing is probably one of the most powerful things, Stephen, that we can possibly do. If you come from a place of something, then you're doing nothing more than expanding upon what was. It might look different, but it's the same old stuff. You come from nothing, and you get to be creative. And then when you can become creative, you can create anything that you want in that universe of yours.
Absolutely. That's a great, great way of looking at it. I have had clients who were mothers, were wives, were professional people that for a variety of reasons, their whole lives had fallen apart. And the one thing I found was that it all interweaves in some fashion to the other. And they were literally almost paralyzed by their inability to move forward. It's a fascinating symptom to see, but that is a common denominator with many of my clients.
Oh, by the way, when you really take a look at it, what I have seen over the years, the biggest problem people have is non-acceptance, lack of purpose. You know, we're dealing with a society today, especially for the most part, you know, we're not listened to, we're not cared about, we're not encouraged to do anything, and that we're not supported and we get forgotten, you know, as a society as a whole. And really, when you come down to it, it's just that acknowledgement, that acceptance to say, I'm a person too, and it's okay for me to be alive. And I think the majority of problems can be solved when somebody gets to realize that it's okay to be exactly who they are and why they are.
Oh, that's perfect, Michael, perfect. That's exactly the point. People sometimes feel they, particularly female clients, no matter what stage of life, no matter what their physical appearance, I call it the Barbie syndrome. They all feel they have to be the perfect Barbie in physical and emotional sense. And it handicaps people. We can't live to the dreams and goals of others. You have to live to your own dreams and goals and find what the term I use is your life song. What's going to make you happy? Not the person that goes to work every day in pure drudgery. What is it you want to do as a person to be successful and to live and to love?
You know, by the way, Stephen, one of the examples that I've used for many, many years now, and I've done it a few times on the air, one of the most important things that we can be, obviously, is accepted as an individual, but take it a step farther than that, the perfection. If you want to define perfection, perfection is the highest form of function. If you're in the pits, you're performing and you're perfect for who you are. The problem is we try to be somebody else's perfect. I can only at my optimum best Stephen be the second best you. I don't care what I did. I can't be a better Stephen than being Stephen than Stephen. And most of us want to be like somebody else because we're told that we're not good enough, so we have to be like them. And one of the things that I have found over the years, I'll usually do this with a woman guest, and I will say, ask me if I'm good looking. And they'll say, yo, are you good looking? And my answer to that is absolutely. And if you don't think so, somebody else will. And that's really where the key is. If I had five women standing in front of me right now, and I had the ability to get behind each one and look through their eyes to see me, I'd see everything from gorgeous to ugly, right? I can't please everybody. So the people who think I'm pretty are the people that I'll attract, and they'll be a magnet to the two of us. But that's where the problem is. You can't be pretty to someone who's not going to think you're pretty no matter what you do.
Well, Michael, take that to another level. And how about so many people who crave that person's attention and become so singularly focused on that person? And in my experience, in my coaching clientele, many women, it doesn't matter what the economic, educational background is, socioeconomic, become fixated on the concern of their partner, their partner's concern and vision of them and how they see them, that client becomes that image. And they can always chase it, but never become it because it is not who they are.
Right.
And I have clients that I've worked with and said, if your husband, your boyfriend, your fiance thinks you should do this, believes you should act like this, and you don't feel that way, it is time for you to make some clear-cut, defining decisions right now and say, is this my life I want to live?
No, absolutely. And because when it really comes down to it, we meet somebody, for the most part, as human beings, we meet somebody. Well, I don't want her I don't want to show myself to her. I'm going to show her who I think she would like me to be. Now, all of a sudden, she likes me and she likes me, but I'm putting this mask on. 6-8 months go by, a year goes by, the problem starts because when I get comfortable, I'm going to become me again. And that's where we have many, many split ups because the person that they were in the relationship with is not the person that they started out with.
Absolutely. And you know, it's interesting, Michael, my background, just to share with you and your listeners, is I was a corporate trainer for many years with the company, and I found that working with base employees, the employees that dealt with customers and clients every day, working on their personal development, their team development, an interesting thing appeared to me, that there was a definite difference between the male and female employees. As I started to explore that a little bit more, my background being an interfaith minister, a Reiki practitioner, I kind of merged these in and really focused, meditated, and studied on what can I do with these employees? Why are they so different? And as I started to speak with them outside of that classroom environment, I found that many of those ladies were doing exactly what you said, trying to live up to the image of the husband or the boyfriend or the significant other of whatever sort and never being themselves. My experience was that the men had different ideas, but that's where the ladies fell into place.
Yeah.
And I felt that that was an unmet need to coach females like that, whether they're 20 or 80. That was an underserved environment that I felt called to be in.
Now, by the way, and I hear you loud and clear. I'm going to pull out my magic book here, and this usually comes out 2 or 3 times a week. I found it, and it's the Milk and Ice Cream Drivers and Dairy Employees Union, Local 225, Dairy and Ice Cream Agreement, 1964 to 1967. Okay, this was in the Milwaukee area. This is my page 77, Article 15, Female. The employer shall not employ female help or any identical operation as now performed or heretofore performed by male help. Now that was in the union. But the point is there's that feeling of that a lot of women still have that they don't belong in certain places and they're going to shut up and they're going to listen and they'll get along fine. That's not the world today.
No, not at all. Not at all. In fact, I worked recently with a lady who is an executive with the Fortune 500, extremely successful, every bit the American dream, the home, the husband, the car, the children, the private schooling, and inside she was just a shell. She was doing what her parents had wanted her to do. She never really wanted to be a financial executive. And we talked. We work through things, and she's actually now transitioning, taking courses to be what she always wanted to be, which was a social worker. A great fit for this client, a success story. She's made her money in the business world. She'll still be able to work and support her family, but do something she loves.
By the way, I'll give you some of the magic that stops problems before it happens. I learned this, but this was a take on something that I learned on the radio when I was doing an interview. Somebody was talking about, they had a book called The First Kiss that could make or break a relationship. And I got to thinking about that afterwards. And when you really come down to it, Stephen, what would happen if two people met and they started to fall in love? And they were getting closer to really getting into a relationship. But before they got into the relationship, they sat down and they said, how do you receive love? And I wonder how many people actually know how their partner receives love. You can guess. Maybe you're supposed to know, but it doesn't work that way. I meet somebody, we fall in love, and maybe my way of expressing love is a wink, a look, a tone of voice, expression, something. And hers is, you buy her something, that means I love you, just as an example. So we're together, you know, a couple, 3 years go by, and I walk in one day, and she's all packed up. She's ready to go. And I look at her, and I say, well, where are you going? She says, well, I'm leaving. Why are you leaving? You don't love me. What do you mean I don't love me? You never show me. Because I never knew how she received it, so I couldn't show it to her, and I didn't know all those years. That's not me, but that's a hypothetical. And I really believe that's part of it. We're frightened to death to ask the other person how they receive love or any of those very intimate personal questions that could stop a problem before it starts.
Now, that's excellent, Michael, excellent. And unfortunately, for many clients that I have, they've gone so far past the mark of walking out the door that there's almost a point of no return for them. A wise man once told me when I was in high school, the woman you meet and want to marry, you should sit down on the front stairs of her home or yours, have a couple bottles of root beer, and talk about everything. Talk about money. Talk about love. Talk about your families, your extended families. And that's not done today anymore by and large. We're in a 21st century age where everyone has a BlackBerry or an Android, and it's instant, instant, instant. And to take that instantness and return it to a sweeter, longer, more beneficial relationship, it's a difficult process.
Oh, no question. Stephen, I'll give you an example of a definition of some words, and people do this all the time. The difference between being dumb and being stupid. Dumb is you don't know any better and you get into it and maybe there's a problem. Stupid is when you know better and you do it anyway. And that's what one of my heroes, who I think should be president of the United States today, but he's already gone, John Wayne, his most famous quote was, life is tough, but if you're stupid, it's worse.
That's very good. That's very good. I know I found in my own practice, and I must say that I work with clients in about 30 states in our country. I work with several clients in Canada. I actually have some clients in the Middle East, and this is all by referral, believe it or not. The one constant remains is the love aspect always comes into it, the ability or the inability to successfully have a long-term loving relationship. Some of them aren't dumb. Some of them are dumb. But many of them make, to use your word, many of them make stupid choices. And before they know it, they've crossed the Rubicon and it's too late.
Yeah. And by the way, using the word stupid doesn't call anybody a name. It's called wake up. If you know better, don't do it. But most people don't
exactly.
know better. They jump
exactly.
in and it never happens. Life is an accident. It's not an accident.
Well, I must say that the variety of clients that I've been blessed to work with, and I do mean that, I receive oftentimes as much or more from my professional relationship with them. It is a blessing to work with them. It's a blessing to see our working together blossom into their future success and repositioning them. I wish sometimes the conversation you and I are having today could be played for much younger boys and girls and young men and young women so they don't fall on the far side of love and relationship damage and breakup. It would be for a much better world.
Well, absolutely. No question about it. And it is just that coming together and that bridge of understanding both ways and then recognizing what it truly is, then you can make your decisions if you want to be someplace or not be someplace. But if you go in with misinformation, not false information, misinformation, you're never going to be on target and you're never going to get the full value of what it could have been.
Oh, absolutely agree. Absolutely agree. In my own practice as a life coach, I have taken the proverbial bull by the horns and realized that while there are a lot of clients who have the means to work with me, there are a lot who either don't recognize such a thing as a life coach or have the ability to be able to afford that service. In my own case, I go out within my community and the greater area, and I've tried to and been successful with partnering with some battered women's shelters to go in And not on a one-on-one basis, because at that point, when a woman goes into a shelter, she is so, if you'll excuse the term, shell-shocked by the abuse of a partner, that it might be difficult for her to particularly sit one-on-one with a male. But I go in, and I try to explain, I'm a life coach. Let me tell you a little bit about life coaching. Let me tell you where some clients in the past have been, right in your seat, and let me tell you how you can step away from it. So I make it more macro than micro, but give them the opportunity to see that light bulb, that light at the end of the tunnel, and know today might be bad, but tomorrow is better.
And by the way, we're going to finish with this because we have run out of time. Before I give you the finish of this, website we can find you at?
It is lifeworksbystephen.com.
Okay,
and Stephen, my webmaster, I've hired a webmaster to work with me on that. It is up. It is live. There is some continued construction going on with it, but it is up and live. My contact information is there. I do work with clients via email, many clients. I work with many clients telephone. We do telephone sessions just because of geographically our distance is so great. And I do also do in-person consultations.
Wonderful. Now, by the way, there are three kinds of people in this world and only three. Those who make things happen, those who let things happen, and those who say, what happened? Stephen, hey, thank you so much for being here.
Michael, thank you. I appreciate it. Have a great evening.
You too. Good night.
Good night.
You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you gon' get, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so quick, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging, you're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way.
Hello?
And if you now, some of these days,
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Whatever you've done, it's all over. Wherever you've been is so strange. Yesterday.
Gordon James Giannotto with us. He is a certified genius, having been identified at age 15 with a grant from the National Science Foundation to study astronomy, space science, in the hope that he would be a future astronaut. He was a practicing defense lawyer, a contractor, a contactee as his wife, and then positioned himself to be an ET spokesman. At this time, living in an inexpensive home, he and his wife build on the wilds of walking the talk, as the people should be doing at this time. And the subject is Planet X and the pole shift. And let's say hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm delighted to be on your show, even though you're only giving me 18 minutes, I hear.
Oh, yeah. But that, by the way, you can always come back, so don't worry about that. Now, let's get into this as quick as we can, Gordon, because I think it's an important issue to be taking a look at. In the world that we live in today, there's got to be more than just that linear thinking of what something should be like. There's things that go way beyond what we can even fathom at this stage of the game. So let's go to Planet X and the pole shift. Where did you realize that this topic in and of itself had an effect on how we live our lives daily?
Well, it has to, because this is going to change everything. And every 3,657 years, a planet trailing twin strands of moons, rocks, and iron ore dust comes through our solar system. The last time is in the Bible. If you look at Joshua 10, you'll see Joshua describing how the sun stopped in the sky and set in a different place. If you read the Old Testament and you see the 10 plagues of Egypt, it resembles very closely what we're going through now, weather-wise and conditions. So the last time it happened was 3,657 years ago, and that's been going on for perhaps 2 billion years. So this is a natural event. It isn't a one-time event. It's something that basically makes history start over from scratch. It's like all record-keeping goes to hell.
Okay, but Gordon, when we take a look at this, okay, forget the record keeping and we see what's going on today, especially what went on in Japan and South Korea. I mean, this list goes on and on and on, from tsunamis to whatever. Does it get worse each time? What I'm saying to you is, are we going to be able to live through this one, and then the one that comes in X amount of hundreds of years from now is really going to be even more devastating? Do they grow in impact as time goes by?
No, there have been some good ones and some bad ones all along. For instance, the flood was a very minor one. But this one is the last one, because the Earth is about to go to a higher level of consciousness. Some people call it the change from the third dimension to the fourth dimension. But the planet that's causing this problem, Planet X, which is also in the Sumerians called Nibiru, and it has a phrase which it's identified by glyphs around the world on prehistoric monuments. It's called the winged globe, because it looks like a planet that has wings. It looks like a bird wheeling in the sky. And it comes back every 3,657 years, but this is the last time for Earth, because we're about to ascend to a higher vibration. And in this level, there's a mixture of selfish and unselfish. And as you know yourself, every time somebody really good gets a really good thing going, somebody selfish will come along and figure out a way to screw it up. So this is a time when we live with the selfish mixed in with the unselfish. And then there's a majority who don't even know there's a choice. But in the next level up, there's a complete separation. Everybody gets their own planet. So the selfish go to planets where there are people as or more selfish than they are, and the unselfish get to work together with unselfish extraterrestrials from all over the universe. So that's the meaning of the phrase, the meek shall inherit the earth, and it's the meek, but not the stupid. So right. There is going to be a dying out of selfish people.
Okay. Now, by the way, I grew up in the 50s. I went to junior high school, high school, middle 50s. I graduated in 1960. That said, I have watched the cultural changes over all of these years. I've seen many different ways people take on their lives. I've watched politics do what politics does. I've watched people die. I remember when you could walk down the street at night and not worry about somebody going to attack you, where I wouldn't dare do that in any inner city today. And I'm watching what's going on, and there does not seem to be any kind of a control, any kind of a fix to it. It's out of, it just keeps growing. And it gets worse, and the volume of it is getting worse. And if something doesn't happen, I believe we're going to go right to exactly what you said. We're going to get to that point where you can't pull it back. You can't make it better. And where do you go from there?
Well, that's exactly what's happening. And the reason why is because the elite, the rich and the powerful, particularly the military-industrial complex, and even the banking industry, although they're now on the other side, they're on the side of the average person, and I'll tell you why in a moment, but they have, the powerful have drained the economy knowing that this would come. NASA has known for 60 years that this would happen because extraterrestrials told them. And people think, well, extraterrestrials, if you believe in them or you see them, something's wrong with you. But the thing is, the government made contact with selfish extraterrestrials, and that's why they've gone out of their way not to disclose anything that they've done or tiny knowledge that they have. But now they're realizing that they're going to have to go through pole shift just like the rest of us. And the unselfish extraterrestrials have promised to help all those who make a conscious choice to be unselfish. And I don't mean saintly. I mean people who care for other people at least 51% of the time. And you know who you are because you have empathy. And if you see selfish people, you realize they have a severe lack of empathy.
You know, I think selfish and unselfish, and when somebody is, you know, if they have empathy, if they're empathic, and they can live vicariously through someone else for the moment to understand where they come from, that other person, that's, for the most part, I've seen is learned. The selfishness is learned. The non-selfishness is learned, and it's modeled by people who we look up to. And I really believe that the answer to this planet is to relearn what we've already learned. And if we're not going to relearn it, and if we're going to move on to where I think that we're heading, that's going to be total disaster, because it's going to be a free-for-all out there. And to survive, you're going to have to be able to have it together a lot.
Well, the thing is that less is more. So the thing is that possessions have been chosen by so many people as being more important than other people. And that's basically where we went wrong. But this pole shift is not just a geographic change and a lot of deaths and destruction. So I could sum that up in Run for Your Lives. But really, it's a spiritual graduation. It's like my wife says, the bus is waiting. The bus is running. Are you ready to get on it or not? And I call it a secret door, just like in Sherlock Holmes, Arthur C. Doyle book. There's a secret door right in front of you, and it's a conscious choice to be unselfish in intention and deed. And that does not mean to be stupid or to let selfish people take advantage of you, but it just means that 51% of the time you think of other people first, and you care about other people, and you realize that at some level we're all one. So if you hurt somebody else, you're actually hurting yourself. And when you realize that, you open this magic secret door, and you enter a level of consciousness that it enables you. It holds the key to the next level, which is the fourth dimension, which is coming to Earth within 100 years.
What I think is going to happen, I'm just going to go off the top of my head with this, that the end result of everything we do, of the actions, there's an energy behind it, and there's a universal energy. And when I say universal energy, it's when you get somebody moving in the same direction and you've got hundreds of thousands of people who believe a certain thing, there is an energy that drives them. The energy of selfishness and the energy of non-selfishness, being empathetic towards people, that's also learned. You have it inside, but you can learn to be that way, or it can be taken out of you also. So when you talk about an energy, if that energy gets strong enough on the other side, there is going to be an explosion, because people are going to start to kill each other. And when that starts to happen, that energy gets completely out of whack. And I really believe the next step is what you're talking about.
Well, this might happen within a year. That Japan was just the beginning. Japan's going to be rocked from south to north with huge quakes that are going to shatter it completely. The basic thing that's happening with the Earth is that the Pacific is narrowing and the Atlantic is widening. So the Eastern Asian continent is going to be folded under and disappear. Indonesia, Malaysia, the coast of Thailand and Vietnam are sinking right now. India is going to slam under the Himalayas like a drawer slamming shut on a dresser. And the Atlantic Rift is going to rip open wider. And what's going to happen is the Caribbean and Latin America are going to disappear. The St. Lawrence Seaway is going to widen. When the New Madrid Fault goes off hours after Japan is shattered, then salt water is going to reach the Great Lakes and forever be connected to the Great Lakes, and they will be all salt water. And then within hours, the Atlantic Rift will be rocked by a huge earthquakes, and the Atlantic Ocean will actually get wider and send a huge 300-foot tsunami washing over the United Kingdom, wiping out Denmark and all the lowland Baltic countries. And this is just 7 out of 10, and 10 out of 10 is pole shift. So Planet X is right between the sun and the earth right now, just off to the side of it. If you look at sunrise, it's to the lower left of the sun, and at sunset, it's to the lower right of the sun. And if you go outside and face south, you can figure out how it changes sides. It doesn't change side. It just goes over your head and down the other way. So this is could happen at any time. And there's an event calendar, but it's not a time calendar. So the elite have known of this, and they've tried to drain as many resources as they can to get ready for this. And they thought that perhaps they could go to the moon or Mars, which has been the whole purpose from day one of our space program, is to save the rich and powerful and have them come back as kings of the earth. So NASA has known this. NASA is actually taking pictures of Planet X on most days with their SOHO satellites. And you can go to their website. They download a new picture every 10 minutes. And you can see for yourself if it's in the picture. It looks like a bird with wings. So,
go ahead.
So they've been covering this up. So the reason why I'm speaking out is because, first of all, I became convinced of this at a much earlier time than most people. And as time has gone on, I've seen more and more evidence that this is true. And then I discovered that there was, my wife and I were looking around saying, who's saying what we're saying? And we discovered the ZetaTalk.com website. And this woman's in telepathic contact with Zetas, and she asks questions that are posed to her by the public. And they answer, and she posts the answers on her website. So this is free. It's available to everybody. And as it turns out, half the Pentagon, half the White House, leaders around the world read Zeta Talk every day. So this is like the inside information if you want to know what's about to happen.
Okay, but if it happens in the year, you say it'll happen within a year, mm-hmm. is that when the population is divided? Or does that start the quote-unquote apocalypse?
Well, that's why if it was announced today, probably, you know, you can just imagine people aren't going to show up for work. There's going to be riots. There's going to be shootings. It's going to be bad. But the thing is that the government could have told everybody 50 years ago and moved everybody to high ground, because as the Earth spins, it accumulates water at the equator. And when the Earth stops spinning for a few days, all the water is going to move back towards the poles. And then when it starts up again, it's going to create a 600-foot tidal surge, just like the tsunami in Japan that was 33 feet. It's going to create a 600-foot tidal surge that by itself is probably going to kill 60% of the world's population. And in the next year, another 30% will die because of shock, starvation, disease, and other people. And that leaves about 10% of the present world population will survive this, and that's all.
No, but where are the safe spots? Or are there any safe spots?
There are safe spots, and Zeta Talk lists all of them, country by country, area by area, and what you can do. But the basic thing you want to do is get more than 100 miles from any coast, at least 200 feet up, and more is better.
No, I hear you loud and clear. Gordon, we're just about out of time. Website, we can find you and get more information. We'll have you back on.
Okay. Well, I'd love to be back on, and I hope this gets people motivated, because obviously I'm not a stupid person, and I'm telling you this is happening, and nobody's telling you. And even the president, if he announced it, I'm convinced he wouldn't even be alive for dinner. So there are people in the background that don't want anyone to know.
Yeah, but can you prepare for something like this?
You can, and you've got to realize we're going to go back to the year 1825, technologically speaking. So you've got to watch those shows on TV about surviving in the wilderness. You've got to buy books on edible food in your area. You've got to be able to go out your door and live for a day without going to a grocery store. Feed yourself from your yard. If you can do that, you have a good chance of surviving.
Gordon, hey, thank you so much, and we'll have Susie Greenman give you an email you, and we'll reschedule you on the show.
Oh, thank you very much. I'd love to.
Good night.
Good night to you.
You know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so good. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days. Miss my hugging, you're gonna miss my kissing, you may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel.
for you. Whatever you've done, it's all over. Whatever you've been is so strange. Yesterday's long gone forever. Damned if what you're feeling isn't changed. Music.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. She's back, Susan Marshall, the author of How to Grow a Backbone, 10 Strategies for Gaining Power and Influence at Work. And we're going to talk about, we're going to do the C word, confidence. My goodness. Susan, how are you?
Hi, Michael Ray. I'm good. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm just so nervous. I'm talking. I don't know if I'll say the right thing. What am I going to do?
Yep. No worries.
Segue in.
You know what? Well, and I was fascinated to listen to the guy that you were interviewing just, you know, before, just hearing the tail end and not having any context. But, gosh, he was talking about learning how to survive.
Yes.
And what I want to talk about, you know, the three elements of backbone, competence, confidence, and risk-taking. Tonight I'd like to talk about competence.
Wait, can I tell you what you didn't hear? Susan, can I tell you what you didn't hear?
Yes, please.
We got a year before the planet is done.
Well,
so,
you know, he was making those dire predictions.
Yeah.
And so we better relearn how to learn pretty darn quick.
No question.
Yeah. So, but it's been an interesting thing to, as you know, we think about this learning business, because as adults, we're supposed to be smart, right? We're supposed to be competent. We're supposed to know how to do stuff. We're supposed to have answers to things. And when we don't, you know, people kind of look at it sideways, like arrested development. You know, you didn't quite finish. What's the deal? You're a grown-up and you're supposed to know stuff. And it's been interesting as I've watched people in the work that I do, particularly successful, smart people, have a real issue when they confront something that they either don't know how to do or have not been exposed to. And I was just sort of thinking about, you know, how do we get this way? And I remember, even as a kid, this has been a real tough lesson for me to learn, is that you can be really good, and I was good in school, and I loved school and got good grades and all that kind of thing, and was blessed with the ability to write well and speak well. But I can remember being in groups of kids that I thought were, some of them were a little bit older than me, but they would tell jokes. And I'd have no idea what they were talking about, but I'd laugh because I didn't want them to think I was stupid or I didn't get it. And so I think from a very early age, we have this idea that we have to be at a certain level of competence. And if we can demonstrate to ourselves and others that we are there, then our confidence tends to be okay. But when we start feeling inadequate from a competence standpoint, all kinds of crazy things start to happen. So I was thinking, just kind of watching people, have you ever been involved in a conversation where somebody's talking at sort of a 30,000-foot level, and you can tell by other people's eyes are glazed over? They have no clue what this person's talking about, but they'll stand there and nod their heads.
Yeah.
And it's almost like it's socially trained behavior, and we literally reach a point, and again, going back to the successful, smart people, reach a point where they believe they've learned enough. And I listen to the debates and the in Washington and the nonsense and all of that. These guys are making stuff up because they're supposed to be the smartest people in the country, with regard to the budget and the debt and all of that kind of stuff. How scary when you watch them talk. Half these guys don't even know what they're talking about.
No, but you're not supposed to know any different.
No, that's right. And we're not supposed to question. And yet we are at a point of flux in our society where we absolutely have to relearn how to learn, whether it's learning how to survive because in a year the planet's going to be gone, whether it's relearning how to have a conversation with someone when we've been glued to our technologies, whatever it is that we confront that puzzles us, we cannot step back from and say, oh, well, you know, I don't need to know that. Somebody else will take care of that. If we are going to communicate with one another about things that matter to us, we're going to have to continue learning new vocabularies, new ideas. My goodness, look at our multi-generational workforce, our multicultural workforce. We need to continue learning from each other, and we haven't. I mean, we haven't gone there. If you say something to me that is an idea that is not somewhere in my cranium or I haven't heard somewhere before, if I am at a place where I think I've learned all I need to learn, I'm going to resist your idea, I'm going to label you some kind of a kook, and I'm going to get away from you.
Yeah, but you can't be wrong. Susan, I'm not talking about you personally, but you can't be wrong.
Right.
You're going to get away from it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. And so the implications of that, we are beginning to see, and I see it a lot in the work that I do with multi-generational people. The baby boomers don't have a clue about the millennials. The millennials don't have a clue about the baby boomers. And because they were raised so differently, and the life experiences that they had as they were growing and developing are so different, they now simply label each other and dismiss. And business is paying a price for wasted productivity, for time spent in conflict, and we're losing, more importantly, we're losing the incredible value of the shared ideas. We're not helping each other get smarter. We're getting stuck in our little silos, if you will.
Sure, and one person may not have it all, but that one person may have a piece of it, and somebody else may have a piece of it, and that's the collective learning.
Yes, and so I'm thinking, so how do we sort of jumpstart this, even this interest, if we accept the premise that we all, no matter where we are on the developmental continuum, right, whether we've gone to school, whether we've done graduate work, whether we've got a tremendous technical skill or an inherent talent of some sort, wherever we are, how do we get back to learning how to learn? And I think everybody would be bored silly if we said, all right, we're going back to the classroom. Oh, please. But the notion of curiosity, if we can help people learn to be curious again about what other people know, about what's happening in the world, about where this man thinks the end of the planet is coming from, to be curious about that opens our minds and puts us in a place of being interested. And now we're not thinking about what we lack. We're looking at what somebody else is bringing. We have to repeat that a lot of times. And we have to adopt sort of a playful stance. Now, I do a lot of work with engineers, docs. The word playful makes them run screaming from the room. I'm an idiot.
Sure.
I'm a lightweight. I'm a fluffball. I don't know what I'm talking about. Playful has no place in an engineer's very precise means of going about his or her work.
But they play when they're working. But
their
work is a toy.
They play in their particular sandbox, yes. And sometimes, and academics are very good at this, sometimes they use their sandbox to exclude all others, to keep themselves in an exalted position so they're never challenged, so they never have to explain an idea, so they never have to explain a rationale. And we see that, too, particularly with successful people. You know, you get to a certain level, all of those people below you, they will never, never know what you know, and so they can just be dismissed.
Look at politics, for instance. Look at politics. There's a euphoria that goes on. I remember years back, I would do interviews with someone who would, you know, they wanted to get into politics. Why? Because they were tired of what's going on. They're angry. They're going to change things. Right. And then they would get in and they'd get an office and I'd interview them when it was time to be reelected. They were a little different. Let them be in there a couple of sessions and they were completely different people. There's like this euphoria. It's like a drug power.
Yes. Yeah. And the power of the group, the peers, you are expected to dine a certain way. You are expected to have, you know, minions following you. You are expected to have. And I, well, to that very point, I'll be very interested to see how our Senator Ron Johnson does, because he's a very salt of the earth, you know, come through the ranks, ran his business, common sense kind of guy. And so he's sort of my benchmark to see what happens. But he is demonstrating a wonderful ability to continue to learn. He's asking questions. He's not in a defensive posture, at least that I can tell yet, where he's confronting things in Washington that he doesn't understand, or means of getting things done that he doesn't understand. He's interested, he's involved, he's rolling up his sleeves, and he's saying, help me understand how this works, rather than saying, oh my gosh, I'm inadequate, I'll never get it.
By the way, you said a very a good word, okay? The word was interested. You see, most of them are interesting, and they are about themselves.
Yes.
Those will really become states personages. I'm saying that right. States,
yes.
Statesmen.
Very good.
Whatever they are. Okay. Article 15, page 77. They're interested. They're interested in who? They're interested in you. That's the important thing. Interesting, go away. Interested, I'm yours.
Well, and that's, you know, there are, we think about, so how, what are some things that we can do individually and even in our own little private selves if we say, okay, well, I'll accept this and I want to now relearn how to learn without having to open textbooks and go back to school. One of the things I could do, you can do, we all can do, is ask questions and, to your point, be genuinely interested in the answers. That's different from asking a really bright question and having everybody look at you and go, oh, that was a really good question. You're really smart, right? Completely different orientation. Again, getting away from focus on self and really putting the focus and the interest on the individual that you're talking to or the subject you're studying or, you know, the flower that you're inspecting, really being interested in that subject. There's sort of a caveat to this. When you ask a question and you're genuinely interested in the person's answer, you will occasionally run across people who will go on and on and on and on, way past your ability to be interested, way past your ability to stay focused. So another aspect of this is practicing how to end conversations. I had lunch today with a guy who was completely oblivious of the fact that he lost three of the four people at the table because he kept yammering on. He was so excited about the brain research is what we were talking about, that he had no idea that some of the things that he was talking about as revelations to him have been studied 40, 50 years ago. And so, you know, we've also got to get good at saying, gosh, that was really fascinating. Thank you so much. You know, it's time for me to go, or excuse yourself from that. So asking questions and being genuinely interested in the answers is a way to elevate the curiosity and really start activating it again. The second way to kind of get reengaged in the learning process is to take time to figure things out. One of my favorite books on the planet is Scott Peck's The Road Less Traveled. And he writes in one of his chapters about this very thing. He had decided that he was completely inept in all things mechanical. And he was walking one day and walked past his neighbor's house, and his neighbor was fixing his lawnmower. And Peck stopped and said, gosh, I really admire you for knowing how to do that. And he said, you know what? You could, too. You've just decided to spend your time elsewhere. So if we want to relearn how to learn, we've got to take time to start figuring things out. Personal story. 3.5 months ago, I was talking to my brother about the grouting in my shower. It was crumbling. It was gross. It was ugly. It needed to be redone. He said, oh, no problem. I know how to do that. I'll be over to do it next weekend. next weekend. Well, 3 months went by. I was upset. I was getting resentful, and I made me a victim. Imagine me, the backbone lady, making me a victim because my brother promised to come and do something that he didn't do. So I, taking my own advice, I said, you know what? You have two options. You can continue to wait, or you can figure out how to do it and do it yourself. So I went over to the hardware store, explained the situation. They said, here's the process. Here's what you need to do. Here's the tool. Here's the new grouting. I came home 2.5 hours later. It was done. I took time to figure it out, which gave me a tremendous sense of satisfaction when I had completed it. Complete reversal of looking at it and saying, well, that's beyond me, but I know my brother knows how to do it. So when we take the time and actually take the step to go figure out and then learn to do, tremendously satisfying. And I guess the last point that I want to make here is recognize in the run-up to, gee, I want to continue to learn, I want to continue to grow, I recognize my personal recognition is that I need a whole lot of technology training. Even though I say I'm in technology rehab, there are things that I don't know how to do that slow me down that I need to learn. But the flip side of that is we each of us need to recognize that we know a lot of things that other people don't. We have a lot to bring to the party. Every human on this planet has something to contribute. Even kids who are stuck, you know, in grades behind their classmates, they see the world differently. They put things together differently. They have things to share. Each one of your listeners has things to share. So when we can get to the mindset of being curious about other people, we start being curious about, gosh, what are the things that I can talk about? What are the things that I can contribute to a conversation? And now instead of laughing at jokes that I don't understand, maybe I can tell a story of something that I found to be funny.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, the whole notion of competence as something we have to build intentionally and purposely is true, and we need to continue to refresh. We need to continue to relearn how to learn. Being curious. Develop the curiosity. You know, listening to you and listening to the interviews that you do, your sense of curiosity is what brings all of your interviews alive. Because you are so genuinely interested in the content of what they're saying, helping them understand how to present that. Fun to listen to.
Susan, it's the difference between interested and interesting, and I'm truly interested in every guest.
Mm-hmm. Which makes you a very interesting man, because you've got all of these things that you can talk about that people have brought. Very
30,156 interviews.
Is that right?
Yeah, and growing.
And how many of those do you remember?
None.
Oh, that's a topic for another conversation.
Oh, I know. No, but you know what? I remember the high points out of it. You know, what I've learned and my value for this over the years, that you can't buy the gifts I walk away with.
Right. Yep.
I couldn't ask for a better. I don't work. It's a toy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, by the way, to get somebody to look at this, to really get away from themselves and mm-hmm. move into the way somebody else thinks, it's very hard for a lot of people to do. You know, for years, I've listened to people talk to themselves, present to themselves, sell to themselves, whatever the case may be,
mm-hmm.
and without an idea that people thought differently than they did. It's called, you know, learning to learn. You're talking about this tonight. And the one thing that you have to do is never change, never, ever change. But to be able to relate, to be able to connect with an audience, you have to step outside of yourself and think like the audience thinks. And there's that old adage, and you've personally probably heard me say it a million times, never sell the way you buy. They do it for their reasons, not yours.
Right, right. Yes, and that, you know, and you've worked with me on that, and I still have a long way to go. I still have much, much to learn. But one of the challenges in doing that I have found is, yes, we really do need to connect with the audience where they are and help them get what they want, you know, buy. Everybody wants to buy. Nobody wants to be sold. And yet you can get into a real mental gymnastics trying to figure out what You know, they're thinking what they want. And your answer to that, which I love, ask them.
Emotional satisfaction.
Ask them.
Yeah, oh, that one. Yes, that part. Absolutely. Yeah. Ask.
Yeah. Oh, you know, but even that, when we think about the culture that we live in, if you ask a question of someone who is looking to you to provide something, many people look at that as a declaration of weakness or inadequacy.
Absolutely.
No, ask. It's just, for me, that just the mental image that I just got, it's the same thing as me laughing at a joke I don't get.
Yeah. And if you don't ask, you're never going to know. And if somebody thinks you're stupid because you asked the question, then they don't deserve an answer.
Well, there you go.
Again, we're about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
I most certainly do. The website is www.executiveadvisorllc.com.
Wonderful. I'm going to sit right here till next week.
Okay. Thanks, okay. Michael Ray.
Good night.
Good night.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night, we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
You'll meet and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Said, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours.
Dr. Rick Shams with us. He's the co-author of Thyroid Mind Power, the proven cure for hormone-related depression, anxiety, and irritability. He graduated from Harvard and University of Pennsylvania, did research in the National Institute of Health and Nobel Prize winner Marshall Nirenberg, and has been in private practice for 25 years now. In addition to his medical office work, he's been a member of the clinical faculty of the University of California Medical Center in San Francisco, a founding member of the American Holistic Medical Association, a participant in the Carl Menninger Foundation, and a member of Who's Who in California, as well as nationally. And let's say, Rick, I welcome to the show.
It is a pleasure, Mike. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, let's lay a base before we go into much further. You know, so many of us hear thyroid. Actually, what is the thyroid? Let's lay a definition out so it'll give us a base for what we want to go to. What is a thyroid, and what effect does it have? What's its job in our physiology?
Absolutely. It's very important. The thyroid is a little gland at the base of the neck, but it secretes a hormone that runs the whole rest of the body. The thyroid is the gas pedal for every single thing that we do, every single thing that our brain does. All the rest of the organs are throttled by thyroid hormone. Too little of it, too much of it, you are not doing well.
Oh, so in essence, okay, so if too little, what happens to us?
You get sluggish. Too little thyroid, you become slowed down. You get cool. You get constipated. You get all sorts of mental difficulties like poor memory and depression. Too much of it, then you get speeded up. And you might have digestive irritability. You might have brain irritability where you are anxious or you're having difficulties making relationships work. You can have anxiety, all of this from too much thyroid. Some people actually have phobia and panic.
So let's say, Rick, for instance, let's say I'm in a relationship and we're not getting along too well and I'm getting depressed and I'm irritable and that's causing the problem in the relationship. So I go find myself a psychological counselor and we're doing all of this work back and forth. And what you're saying is it's very possible I could have an underactive or an overactive thyroid triggering this within me and I'm working on a problem that I don't have as opposed to the one that I do have and I'm not getting anywhere.
Absolutely. Thyroid drives the brain. See, the brain is what drives the mind, but thyroid drives the brain. Hormones rule metabolism, and the metabolism of your brain, which is relating to all of the thoughts and feelings and emotions and the memory that we can create or have, is related to how well this particular organ will work. And thyroid determines how well it works in a great many cases.
Now, by the way, you have a three-step health program when it comes to thyroid health. And one of the first step was, and we basically touched on it, but it's uncovering that hidden cause for many mental symptoms. How do you find this out? When you get some of these symptoms, you know something's wrong, what kind of a test do you get? Who do you go to find out if this is truly the problem?
Sure. If you are suffering from some of the physical symptoms like fatigue or overweight, and then you have some of the mental symptoms like depression, anxiety, foggy brain, you have sleep difficulties or maybe cravings or downright eating disorders, and you get to have a diagnosis. You get to see if thyroid is abnormal. If your thyroid is abnormal, it's an easy fix. So this is why it's important to get, first of all, a high level of suspicion. People with fatigue, depression, overweight, dry hair, dry skin, dry eyes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, low libido, sluggishness of bowel function, all of these kinds of things, just being chilly or having cold skin, hair loss, dry skin, you get all of these things from thyroid. If you realize that it might be a thyroid problem, and you decide you want to check into it, then you go and get some tests, okay? You might want to do this, especially if anyone in your family has ever had a thyroid problem. It is the most inherited of all illnesses. So if Aunt Tilly had thyroid, or if your grandmother had thyroid, well, then you are in line for it, and you really ought to get it checked. There are some very, very good blood tests. Standard blood tests are not as good as the new home test technology. You know, you can get a home pregnancy test. Well, nowadays you get a home thyroid test. You don't even have to ask a doctor for it.
Now, by the way, let me hold you up for a minute because it brings up a very interesting question. Let's say that I was going through any of this, the depression, the overweight, the dry eyes, whatever the case may be, and I go into the medical doctor, the average practitioner. Are they going to know to look for thyroid problems with this, or could the average doctor just pass it by only because it has not been within his scope of medicine?
The average doctor is very busy and sometimes will look at a situation where a person has a laundry list of symptoms, like I just mentioned, plus they have some depression, and basically they say, look, I don't have time for this, but here's a prescription for Prozac, or go and get some psychological counseling along with it. This misses the point. It misses the underlying problem. And psychological counselors, as well as regular medical doctors, can miss the true diagnosis. And then you spend years with unnecessary chasing symptoms and difficulties that could have been treated very easily. Even Freud, even the great Freud himself, said that eventually many of the illnesses that plague the mind will be found to have a physical cause that will be treated much more efficiently once we know what it is and how to treat it. Well, thyroid is a very common physical cause of everyday psychological problems.
Rick, in your experience, where was it in your life as a doctor, as a practitioner, when you realized the importance of the thyroid? Obviously, everybody knows how important the thyroid is, quote-unquote, in the medical field, but the effect of the thyroid, those symptoms that may not look like they're tied to the physiology.
I got a very good crash course in this. I married a registered nurse who was pretty healthy and then came down with some of these symptoms. she had a thyroid problem. So having her be in better shape, getting her mother in better shape, having our children getting in better shape, has been a long and difficult road that is now going much better than I would like to say things are going very well now, because we've paid attention to some of these fine details about diagnosis and treatment, so you don't have to suffer needlessly.
You know, an interesting point here, it's with your daughter, Georgiana. What she's done with the book in and of itself, we look at the Western culture, Western medicine, but also there is an Oriental medicine culture that has been very effective over the years, and it's very interesting that you combine the both together.
We do combine them together. Georgiana, my daughter, is an acupuncturist and oriental medicine specialist, but she started into this field partly because she had a thyroid problem. It was inherited from her mother. And this particular field, Chinese medicine, is involved in balance. They balance 14 different meridians when they do acupuncture session. So this is the essence of balance, and the essence of good thyroid care is balance. So she is very up on that. Remember, the Chinese are the same people, the same smart people, who first discovered the use of gunpowder, rockets, coal, paper money, movable type printing. These are smart folks, and the medical care, the traditional Chinese medicine medical care is very useful.
When you really get into this, and when you take a look at it, and you realize the importance, the criticalness of the thyroid, how strong is the message getting out? Are people beginning to realize, are doctors beginning to realize the effect of the thyroid in the many different areas that you just talked about?
It turns out they are. Now, the psychologists and the psychiatrists have been very involved in thyroid for years and years, more so than regular medical doctors, in terms of seeing its importance for psychological health. But more and more, the word is getting out. More and more doctors are involved in this. But with managed care and with HMO telling doctors that they can spend 5 minutes with the patient, you don't have enough time to do a careful history and find out what are the associated illnesses, what is your family history, what about, you know, all of the things that might lead you to a better diagnosis are not done. And they say you get one test. They give you just one of the thyroid tests instead of a whole panel, and you often get a misdiagnosis because of this managed care situation. People need to take this into their own hands and get some testing on their own. You can simply go to our website and find links to labs that will send you a home test kit. The home test thyroid technology is very accurate, more accurate than putting a needle in your arm at a regular blood lab. The labs that would do a home test kit for you have a higher certification from the governing bodies than the regular labs where you put a needle in your arm. So there's new technology that's spreading around. People are coming aware of just how thyroid has quietly mushroomed into one of the most common illnesses in this country, and it causes minor problems, minor psychological difficulties, everyday depressions and anxieties, as well as major phobia, major depression.
Now let me ask you this. We're starting to run out of time. Is there a website we can find you at?
Sure. The name of the book is Thyroid Mind Power. The name of the website, www.thyroidmindpower.com. And there's a quick quiz that you can take to find out if you are a likely candidate for this. There are links to these other laboratories that I told you about. There's suggestions for different regular medicines that you can take, or people that are interested in natural alternatives or the Chinese medicine. There's information about all of that. The key to thyroid is a high suspicion and good information.
No, by the way, I think that's it in a nutshell. High suspicion, good information. Rick, we're out of time. And by the way, I want to thank you so much, you know, obviously for the work you've done. And there's a lot of people out there that really need to hear what you have to say. So get the word out. And thank you so much for joining us.
It is a pleasure. Keep up the good job yourself.
Good night.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see. Such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's...
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. David Hossager is with us. He is the author of The Trust Edge, How Top Leaders Gain Faster Results, Deeper Relationships, and a Stronger Bottom Line. He's a business strategist and a keynote speaker. And through his book and program, The Trust Edge, he shares the secrets of using trust to impact the bottom line. And let us say hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much, Michael. Great to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, David, that word trust is a very interesting word. As it relates to the human being, let's define what that word means, because that seems as though that's going to be the bond, that bridge that will connect two people together, that word.
That's right. You know, a lot of people say, oh, trust, that's just honesty, or that's just this, or that's just that. The way I define it is a confident belief in. If I trust someone, I have a confident belief in that person, that product, that organization, a confident expectation that they'll deliver what they say, that they'll act the same way every time. And so really, trust in on its own is just a confident belief in or expectation in.
Now, by the way, in business, I can see that work, and it also should work in politics. I think that word in and of itself, and I'm not going to get political, but just what we see going on in the country today, because it is a trickle-down effect. If we don't have trust there, we don't have trust in the businesses. If we don't have trust in the businesses, in a world, we can go with that one. So I think it's an extremely important word. Do you think we have lost it and we have to redevelop it, or it's still there, we just don't recognize it?
Well, I think two things. I think, number one, people have lost it for good reason. And number two, there are places that it is that we don't realize. Let's start with number two. I was just in India. My book launched in India. Really exciting to see all that's happening there. However, look, where you can buy off the government, you can buy off your ticket, you can, a speeding ticket, you can bribe your way in or out of that, there's an incredible lack of trust in government and in the financial system and in business as a result. Much, much, much lower trust than in America. So let's go back to number one. America, we have a certain trust issue. We think it's terrible. The truth is, it is terrible in some areas, but it's not even close to as bad as it is many places. By and large, in America, we trust that our money is worth something. We can trust that payment's going to come if someone says it's going to, by and large. We can actually trust, by and large, even our government and certainly our police and government institutions and generally business. And that's why we have the best system that's out there today. In the midst of that, we have lost some trust, and there's some things we can do about it, and there's some disasters that, as you and I both know, are about to happen if we don't.
Absolutely. Now, I want to touch on the eight pillars of trust, but a couple of them that I'm looking at it here, and they stick out because we've found that we've missed this. We've missed this in government. We've missed this in a lot of the major businesses and on Wall Street. One is clarity. There isn't any. And character is an interesting word. Competency. I'm trying to find it, and a connection and consistency. Those are just a few of them that I'm looking for these, and it's very hard to find today that combination of just those in any of the entities that we look at.
Let me tell you, the book is called The Trust Edge, and basically it's this distinct advantage of those that are trusted. It's this edge, this advantage. And wherever we found organizations, this came out of my graduate research and before, but in all the research, these eight pillars that you just mentioned, or some of them, all eight were a part of those that had the greatest impact and generally the greatest bottom line. Now, I did not define success only in bottom line terms, but also in breadth of impact over time. And those that are most successful had all eight. Now, some of these you'll say, boy, that's a simple idea. And the truth is it's not brain, it's not just neuroscience. I mean, here I came up with it. But the truth is very few people and very few organizations are doing all eight. And those that are very successful in impact and in the bottom line. So to your point about the eight, you're right. We have issues. I mean, the eight just very quickly are clarity. People trust the clear, mistrust the ambiguous. Compassion, the ability to think beyond yourself, character, when people, this moral character and integrity, those are different actually, but they add up to character. Competency, this ability, I trust you, Michael, with my kids for the weekend maybe because of your character. I won't trust you to give me a root canal because you're not competent at that, so you've got to be competent in the place you're going to be trusted. And look, we have issues right now in government where you've got these people, they can't run a business, they've never budgeted anything, and now they're in charge of the biggest budget in the world. There's a real competency problem. Commitment. I mean, hardly people have commitment. And you know what? It's not, they were committed to first by Harley with Quality in 1967 when that group took over. I mean, there was a real commitment to the rider, and that's why there's this big commitment back. Connection, as you say, people want to be around friends, people that will connect with them, and we can talk more about it. Contribution, that's the idea that we actually expect results at the end of the day. We want contributors to give us results. If you're just compassionate and kind of high character, but you don't ever give me the results, I don't trust you. However, if you give me the results, but do it in the wrong way without compassion, I also won't trust you over time. And finally, consistency, and that's the king of the pillars. We've got to be consistent. That's how reputations and brands are built. But you're right, there's a problem, and we don't see all of them in government or business very often. Where we see them, we see success, impact, and a greater bottom line.
Well, let me tell you what I just heard, and I think it's extremely important. We started the show out with what is trust, define it. And what I'm hearing very loud and clear, that trust is a process. And if you don't know all of the components, you're not going to reach your end result to achieve the goals that you want to achieve. Trust is not just a word that I trust you. Well, what does that mean? And it means so many different things to so many people. So it's a process.
It is a process, and you know what? It starts often little by little, even though transfer trust can happen very quickly. So, well, you could say trust can be lost in a moment. It's kind of like a a forest takes a long time to build, and yet a touch of carelessness can burn the whole thing down in moments. Trust is like that. On the other hand, we have something I define as transfer trust, and that's where, you know what? If I trust Michael, and Michael trusts Joe, and Michael says Joe's trustworthy to me, then I trust Joe very quickly. He didn't have to take so long to build it. However, he did have to take the time to build it with Michael. So you do have some ways of building it more quickly, but you're right, it's a process, and you're right that all eight pillars, you know, people, you know, some of these things, some of these truths are very timeless. On the other hand, trust is very timely. And some of these things will jump out and say, oh, yeah, I get that, like character. Well, of course you need character as a foundational piece. But then some of them, once you get into it, they really surprise people a little bit and say, oh, I've got to be the first one you said, clarity. They might have well-meaning, great intent, even high character, but they're absolutely not clear, and we don't trust those that are so ambiguous and muddled and vague. We need clarity to trust them. That's why if a salesperson is clear about the benefits, I might buy. If a leader is clear about the vision, I might follow. Clarity is absolutely powerful and needed, but all the pillars are.
No question about it. But one of the things I'm seeing also with the pillars, you talked about the transfer of trust. You trust me, I trust him, I recommend him to you. But let's say, for instance, that your main goal is you want somebody that is compassionate. They have compassion within them. And I trust them because they're clear, they made a good connection, they're competent, they've committed to what they're doing, and we're finding consistency and an end result, the result and effect of what we do. So I say, okay, but you know, Bob's just like that. And you say, great, I'm going to trust Bob. And you get involved with Bob, and all of a sudden, Bob is not compassionate. And everything else that he was is thrown out the window because your definition of trust is that. And I really believe that if you sat down with somebody and said, refer somebody to me, I trust them. And somebody said, what is trust to you? It's this, it's that, it's this. Do they pass the test?
Yeah, well, and what I would say is the definition is pretty much the same for everyone. At least that's what my research would say. It is that confident belief, that confident expectation in them. And so what builds that confident belief? Well, all eight. Consistency, compassion. Hey, if they don't have compassion, I doubt if very many people are going to say they trust them because they don't like them. They don't ever have the ability, that person doesn't ever have the ability to trust beyond themselves. Or that person will say, I trust them with a caveat. I trust that person to give me results. You know, they always fix my car right, but man, they sure are a jerk when they do it. You know, few people will say they just outright trust someone or an organization without all eight pillars. It's interesting how that works, but it takes all eight to really be most trusted or gain what I call the trust edge, this advantage that kind of transcends and builds, you know, the greatest brands, the greatest leaders, the greatest organizations.
Oh, sure. And when you get trusted brands, a great example of that is Coca-Cola. You're going to go out for soda. Sure. You're going to go out for Coke. You're not going to go out for a strawberry.
Yeah.
And that has
exactly. You're right on.
Yeah.
And that's why we go to, you know, here in the Midwest, we say, you know, I might have a caribou. Well, caribou second now to only to Starbucks. But look at, they built it in much faster time. They're doing some unique things, showing they care, showing consistency, showing clarity. I mean, Harley Davidson, you know, people say they ride a motorcycle or they say they ride a Harley. They don't say I ride a Honda or a Yamaha. They, you know, you have dolls, and then you have, if you talk to little girls, you have American Girl dolls. Oh, that's my American Girl doll. Or her name is Josefina or Josefina. Those are most trusted brands. Or I have a Mac. You know, everybody has a computer, or I have a PC, or I have a Mac. Mac is a brand, is one specific company. PCs are any number of companies. But those that really like Mac, boy, they love them, and they trust that brand completely, almost, you know.
I think they almost was good. Yeah, but the communication is extremely important also, because if you don't know what I mean by what I say, and the result and the fact of everything we do is often a different path, then we have a problem there. And I think all of this starts out with the base of the ability to communicate in a way that your target audience, whatever that be, one person, 10 million, has learned to respond.
And that's why the first pillar is clarity, because we got to start on common ground. We've got to be absolutely clear. You know, it's fascinating. Some people hear me on diversity, you know, say, you know what? Diversity doesn't build trust. It's a problem, because what the new, you know, political correctness is what? We need diversity. We need more diversity. Now, hear me out. I absolutely agree that we need diversity. If you and I are exactly the same on a team, we don't have, it doesn't, does us no good. We need differences. We need all that. And so I want people to hear this. And when I say diversity, I am not talking color or gender or anything. I'm just talking diverse thinking. I mean, I grew up on a farm in northern Minnesota. Maybe you grew up in the city. We have a diverse way of thinking at the start. So everybody is more diverse than they think. And some people that look terribly different aren't as diverse as they would think. Still, we're all very different, and we tend to most quickly trust those homogenous. So the homogenous groups are people like us. That's why that epic study out of Harvard from Putnam, you know, this just woke everybody up and was kind of a little bit sensitive politically correct-wise. But because they said, well, diversity, is it really that great? The truth is it is. We need diversity for innovation, creativity, and we need each other. However, we need on teams, we need diversity in the right way. We need some clarity. If we aren't clear about the definition of terms, as you say, if we don't even define trust right, if we're not clear about the vision, if we're not clear about having the same values, then you do have a diversity that fights and muddles and doesn't get anything done. However, with a very diverse group, you can start to build trust when you start by being very clear about definitions, values, vision, mission. Look, on the battlefield, people can be way different, but boy, they'll fight the opponent because they have a very clear vision of where they're headed, and they, all the petty little stuff that used to challenge them doesn't matter at all because they're going to die otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you really come down to it, when people are screaming about ethnicity and gender and this and that and whatever, you know, knock on wood, I've never had to go into combat. I was in the service. I was in the Marine Corps, but it was after Korea, before Nam. So I hit that point where there wasn't, which I would have gone if that's what it would have been. But the one thing that I did learn was this. If you've got somebody at your back protecting you that could save your life, you don't care what their gender is, what their color is, what their religion is. You're there, and you're doing all of those eight pillars at one time.
Yep, there you go. A very good example.
Yeah. Okay, now let me ask you this. We've got about two.
You go ahead.
Okay, I was going to say, we got about 2 minutes to go. Let me ask you this. Let me do it in this way. That with all of your experience, you put the book to pen, obviously. And this happens with most authors, whether it be fact, fiction, fun, fantasy, whatever the case may be. There comes that time somewhere in the middle of the writing when you get this aha moment, this epiphany moment, where you see something about the subject matter that you didn't even know was there. Where was that for you in this writing, in your research?
I would say it started at the beginning. The epiphany was 2003, and I was thinking about what is the uniqueness of the greatest leaders, organizations, brands? What's unique about them? I mean, everybody, you hear motivational speakers on this and that, and you hear people say all kinds of things, and people could say, you know, engagement or leadership or whatever, but what's at the core? And to me, there was an epiphany in 2003 as I was working with teams, serving on boards, you know, speaking at events, that it's trust. And then, you know, I did did my whole graduate research on trust, and really these once I saw the bottom line impact, first of all, that was the thing. That was an aha for me, because there weren't books on it at the time. There was a lot of work on how trust is broken, but not how trust is built. So first, though, was I think people challenge me by saying, oh, trust is just a soft skill. No, it's not a soft skill. It's a bottom-line impactor. And that's the first tie that I made. The first aha was, you know what, this really impacts the bottom line more than people think. You think it's a soft skill? Ask Tiger Woods. One breach of trust, or 25 breaches of trust, and he lost millions in weeks, hundreds of millions by now. Your credit score, if you own your own home, it's a trust score. The more you higher the score, the less you pay over the course of the loan. You have to now, at the college, the university I used to go to, to go to the P.O. box, you use a combination lock. It costs time to get your mail now. It didn't used to cost time. So trust, to show, you know, page 20 of the book really shows this. What's the cost? What's the benefits of trust? How attrition and, you know, costs and time and stress and morale and everything stuff really affects the bottom line. So that was an epiphany. Another epiphany was the eight pillars. At first, I thought there were just a few. Then I thought there were more. Then I thought, and it really settled after all the research was done that these eight, it takes all eight. And you know what? Trust is buildable. It's creatable in an authentic way. And that was all another piece of, you know, people can follow this process and they can become a trusted person, a trusted brand, a trusted organization, and it will change their lives. I mean, a lack of trust is your biggest expense. And it doesn't matter if it's at home with your family, in your community, or at work.
No question, David. We're just about out of time. Let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you, your work, and the book?
Sure can. DavidHorsager.com. Horsager's a little tough to spell. TheTrustEdge.com might be easier to remember. TheTrustEdge, E-D-G-E, TheTrustEdge.com. And that's the easiest place. I sure hope people can find a framework for this way of thinking. They can find some hope, I think, for doing things better and gaining more success and a clear path to get there.
And by the way, if they miss it tonight, if it went by too fast, it's going to be sitting on my website forever. So, David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael. Appreciate the time, and all the best.
Take care. Good night.
Yep, good night.
As you're filing out the door, as they say, this bit, that's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, got a funny feeling we're parting out.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
Your cheers and laughter will linger out.